Hey guys, we're back in the studio. If you have any questions, don't be afraid to call us, 593-0013. These guys were arguing and carrying on when we were off the air listening to music. I love it. Let me get back to the question that I asked before the break and said I wanted you guys to think about it. I'm not convinced. I know Walter disagrees with me, and like I said, it's like a college student disagreeing with a professor. Pretty arrogant, I suppose, on my part. But I'm not convinced that we can't manage the Israelis, not control them, but manage them, partly through the pocketbook. And I guess you said, Norman, that we give them $3 million a year. Billion, I'm sorry, B as in boy, $3 bucks a year. And obviously that's a big part of their economy. But I can't imagine them saying, well, we're not going to do this. We're not going to sit down and carve out something that both sides can live with. We're not going to do it. And the United States say, well, okay, if you're not going to do it, then we're going to have to start imposing some restrictions on the money that we give you, because in good conscience, we as Americans can't continue to give you money that you're using for arms and weapons to deal with the Palestinians and the whole Arab issue. I'm sorry, guys. I have a problem with that. I think we can impose some restrictions on them. Go ahead. Have at it.
Well, I think it's hard to understate or overstate, I guess, the degree of political difficulty that involved in any reduction of financial aid to Israel or any other type of aid. The $3 billion a year is a continuation of a much earlier longstanding agreement that gave about $2.75 billion. It was re-signed about 4 years ago when I was in Tel Aviv, and it calls for a 10-year program of $3 billion a year in military assistance exclusively, no more budget assistance like we gave in the previous decades. In addition to that, we give about $1 billion a year in other programs, such as, for instance, the American Schools and Hospitals Abroad program, where we give $1 million grants to the Hebrew University for its business school and to Laniato Hospital in Netanya for developing American-style programs and hospital programs, educational programs. So about $4 billion a year. And I take your point that it seems like an awful lot of money, and why do we have to do this? Particularly since Israel, is, I believe, is now rated the 17th strongest economy in the world by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, Paris, the world body for developing countries. Developed countries, pardon me, developed. On the other hand, the $3 billion a year carries more than just the financial weight, and it's not actually such a huge part of the Israeli economy. But there are two issues. One is that the $3 billion conveys to the world the evidence of United States moral support for the Israel, and Israel is a Jewish state that is standing and defending itself against anti-Semitism and anti-Israel views throughout the world. And that's very important. And any diminution of that is going to be attacked, any proposed diminution of that is going to be attacked viciously as a sign of weakening United States' resolve to support the existence of the State of Israel. But the other issue is that among that $3 billion, if I remember right, 70% of that money is tied to procurement within the United States. So if you're a U.S. defense contractor and somebody comes up with a proposal to cut the $3 billion in assistance to Israel to, say, $1.5 billion, that means that that's 70% of that $1.5 billion is going to come out of the hide of the U.S. defense industry. That's, $1.2 billion a year in sales that the U.S. defense industry won't get. So it's very much tied together with this whole moral support issue and with the defense industry lobby.
Well, that's interesting, Norman. I understand that you have strong feelings about that. But Walter comes at this issue from a different perspective. Not the powerful lobbies that are interested in keeping our contributions to Israel going. But he's looking at it, as best I understand what he's saying, from a totally different perspective. He's talking about Israel being a democracy, the only democracy in the area, and that we've got an obligation to make sure that they survive as a country, as a people, having nothing to do with money.
Well, I was let me just interject that I would take issue with the idea that it's the only democracy in the region, but we'll get to that shortly.
Okay. And I would say it's a qualified democracy because 20% of the population, 20% of Israeli citizens are Arabs, and they don't have equal rights. But my point here is you cannot cut Israeli aid by 50% because it sends the wrong signal to Israel's enemies, which is to say much of the rest of the world. You can't send that moral signal out there because that means, oh, the United States is backing off of its moral commitment to the Israelis, which the United States cannot and should not do because Western civilization, and particularly the United States, has this huge debt to the Jews. It's intellectual, it's cultural, and it's theological. And we can never forsake that. We can never forget what we owe them culturally, intellectually, and theologically. And any sign of abandonment of the Jewish people and the Jewish state I've been to the camps, Oranienburg, Auschwitz, and you can never, ever, ever unleash the cork in the bottle with the anti-Semitic genie in it. You can get angry with the Israelis. You can get, but you just cannot. You cannot allow that that anti-Semitic genie out of the bottle to the point that I think that's what would happen if the United States were to follow through on your suggestion or your idea that there'd be a 50% U.S.
Okay, that being the case, Walter, why then do not the French, the English, all these other major Western powers, why don't they take that same approach? Why aren't they concerned about the things that you just enunciated?
Because they know the Americans will carry the ball for them.
Well, okay. I guess I understand what you're saying, but surely they must have some interest in seeing to it that Israel stays alive as a political entity.
I think this. You should hear the kinds of things Pakistani Muslim Brits talk about these days. These people have large Islamic constituencies, and they're not going to go to bat. That is the Brits and the French and the Germans and the Dutch and now the Swedes. They're not going to go to bat for the Israelis, and the only people who will ultimately go to bat for the Israelis are the Americans. So that's why we can't even legitimately talk about a reduction of aid to the Israelis by 50% or 1% or 2%. It's not going to happen. Look, France is right now 10% Islamic, and it has a very strong Muslim community. The Brits have not that many in numbers, but they have a very powerful and vocal Islamic community there, mostly Pakistanis. But there are African Muslims there as well. The Germans have, I guess, 5 or 6% Turkish now? Let's face it. Vexing as the Israelis can be, we're the last living champion of the Israelis in the world. Because what's really vexing is when you get people in Israel saying, the Americans don't tell us what to do, we tell the Americans what to do, and there's a lot of truth in that. But no matter how mad you get, you can't back away from your moral commitment to the Jewish state of Israel, not just because of the Holocaust, but because of the cultural, theological, intellectual, and historical commitment you have to the Jewish people over the millennia.
Norman, what do you think about that?
Well, in response to your question about the other countries, well, I think there's a good deal less sympathy for Israel than the other countries, in part because they are much closer to the origins of the conflict, and they recognize that more of the legitimate grievance of the Palestinians, while, of course, being horrified by the activities of World War II, the Germans, the Holocaust, the concentration camps. They recognize that, but they have a different balance on the whole issue. And they are looking at the fact that you have a case where a people, the Palestinians, have been displaced from their property and their homes, and they recognize, I think far better than the average American, the impact that that has on non-Western perceptions of the West. That is, and I'm talking about throughout Africa, Latin America, every place, about the intentions of the United States, the intentions of the United States, its attempts to be a global hegemon, at least in their view, and whether we are out there, in fact, they're pursuing some sort of crusader-type effort in support of the Judeo-Christian ethic.
Do you think, Walter, picking up on your theme, do you think it makes any difference whether there's a Republican or a Democratic administration in power in terms of how it views Israel?
Yes, it always makes a difference because remember 8 years of the Bush administration, they decided they were going to ignore the Palestinian issue, do nothing about it, and let the Israelis work their will. They did, and the world's that part of the world's gone to hell in a handbasket. In the meantime, the United States is now involved in wars with Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan. You can't ignore the Palestinian issue. It's central to peace in the region and everything else. Having said that, I'm not sure where I was going with the idea, but you can't ignore it. And there is a big difference between I think the difference between Republicans and Democrats on the Israeli-Palestinian issue is at least as big as the difference between Democrats and Republicans on global warming and environmental issues.
In terms of the upcoming election, do you think any of this is going to play into our congressional elections? I'm switching gears a little bit here, but I'm curious as to whether you guys think that that's going to have some outcome on the election, those that support Israel and those who do not support Israel.
I don't think it has so much of an impact on those who support or not support Israel. I think the current talk, were they to result in some sort of a framework or tentative agreement with some modestly predictable train of events leading to peace, would of course enhance the Obama administration's chances. It would show their expertise in foreign affairs, show their dedication to the early statements of the president. Very, very positive effect. On the other hand, the more likely outcome is failure, or if not failure, then no progress at all. Then those are two different things. In which case, it will be held against him. It will be taken as amateurish attempts at resolving the Middle East peace process. And I think the opponents of the administration will say, you wishy-washy Democrats who don't understand how it is to deal in the real world screwed up again. So it will have an effect, could have a very positive effect. I think failure will have some sort of a negative effect, but only if there is some sort of real framework leading to a recognizable peace will have a positive impact.
If the Israelis have all the cards, which I think we would all agree is the case, they have no incentive, unless I'm missing something, they have no incentive to give back the land or a portion of the land that they took from the Arabs and maybe make major financial contributions to the building of industry, et cetera, in Gaza and other places in that part of the country. So why this charade? What's going on in Washington? Is this to appease the international community to show that the politicians are, in fact, really doing something? Or is there something going on here that we just don't know, that there's a reason why the Israelis do, in fact, are looking for a way out?
Well, there's an awful lot going on. You've covered a whole bunch of things right there. One, I think the president came into office with a determination to try and make progress in this, and he thought he could, and he appointed our own George Mitchell, a man of true dedication, experience, realism, pragmatism. This is a guy who's been there and done it, and if you don't think so, just think about what it's like to be Senate Majority Leader. In addition,
or to try to deal with the Irish problem.
Well, that's right, but I think the Senate's tougher myself. Anyway, so you've got George Mitchell in there. You've got a serious player. We all know George Mitchell. He wouldn't be playing around with this if he really didn't have what he thought was the backing of the president. He's got other stuff he could be doing and making a lot more money. Then you've got the those people who would, in fact, the Democratic Party operatives who would like to see some sort of a success. And then you do have, in fact, a very vocal, if not very strong, peace community that is constantly pressing this. You know, I commend the people of, for instance, Americans for Peace Now, or the any of the various organizations, much lower profile, that work on this issue. But so I think it's a serious effort, although I think the administration demonstrated in the early months of this administration that they didn't quite get it, and they didn't necessarily have people who could talk to them in the, about the on-the-ground issues that Palestinians and Israelis face. But back to the other issue you raised, which was, where's the interest in Israel toward this thing? Israel does have a significant portion of the population that says it wants peace and is willing to make concessions. But by and large, because of its multi-party governance, you know, it's a parliamentary system, tiny factions control vast weight within the government. And the ultra-Orthodox parties and the religious settler parties always have the winning hand. They're the ones that form the critical votes in keeping any Israeli government going, and have at least since 2002. I won't talk before that, but when I showed up in Israel for my second tour of duty in 2002, they were playing the key cards. So, now where was I going in that? But what's happened is, with the construction of the security barrier and continued U.S. support and continued U.S. wielding of the Security Council veto whenever necessary, the Palestinians are basically behind the wall. Israel's economy is doing very, very well compared to most developed countries. As I said there, I believe they're number 17 in the OECD list of developed countries. Life is very, very good in Israel. And so you've got to be a very strong personality or have some very strong political beliefs in human rights and settling the conflict to say, I think I'll go and start lobbying my government and my neighbors to start giving up land that we seem to be holding very securely and comfortably now. And the phrase I use is, life in Israel is extraordinarily tolerable right now, not like it was during the Second Intifada or the First Intifada when there were suicide bombings. And so their security measures have made life very, very comfortable. United States support remains extraordinarily strong. And there isn't much incentive for anybody to go out there and start moving for peace, other than those that are distinctly in the lobby.
And how about the other side? I mean, it seems obvious that that they hope that they'll get, if not their original land back, something comparable, some trade-off of land, and get a lot of money from the Western world to begin developing some industry in the Arab lands. Obviously, that's where they're headed. And when I step back from all of this and put the religious aspect of it aside, I don't understand why we cannot come up with a formula that will deal with this problem. I know Walter just shakes his head when I say that. Like, where is this guy from? Mars? I mean, I've talked to... I've talked to diplomats all over the world, and nobody sees a resolution to this problem.
And you're going to buy a Palestinian microchip or a Chinese microchip or a Japanese microchip. What do the Palestinians make that... that they can peddle in the international market of the 21st century? They got marble, great marble, but they got to pay the price of shipping it through Israeli territory to get it out. They make glass and handicrafts and pottery, but we're in the 21st century, the age of the microchip, and the Palestinians are, you know, because of the various intifadas, educationally decades behind Israel, the West, and so forth. I'm not even sure they can compete.
Okay, but in terms of the numbers, Walter, think about the numbers in the Islamic world as opposed to the rest of the world. How can you ignore those numbers?
It's real easy because, as Norm said, the Israelis are the 17th most vibrant economy in the world, and they've got 5.6 million people, something like that, and you've got 200 million Arabic numbers, and they don't count because the only thing they've got is oil. And if you come up with a magic formula to shut off the oil spigot, then the Arabs count even less.
Yeah. Well, the Arab states also have to weigh their relationship with the United States. They only have about so much play. They want to maintain their lifestyle. They sell oil. We buy oil. There's a market out there. But one of the things that impressed me I guess I would say unfavorably, or I was concerned about, was the Israeli unwillingness to consider the Arab Peace Initiative in 2002. And it's worth remembering that there have been various initiatives over the years, most of them ham-handed, very poorly constructed. But the Arab Peace Initiative in 2002 actually offered total Arab-wide diplomatic, commercial, and other ties and recognition between Arab states and Israel in return for a just peace and settlement with the Palestinians. And it was basically spurned, and the United States spurned it as well. And since then...
Well, I think Arafat spurned it, didn't he?
No. He would not go against his Saudi bankers.
No. There were obviously questions about what the settlement would be. But the idea was enter serious negotiations now, and when the Palestinians agree, then that triggers the whole mechanism. So it was left to the Palestinians-Israelis to negotiate. Those negotiations never took place. And part of that...
You're not telling me why, but I'll be patient.
No, they never took place. I think part because of the United States... first of all, Israeli objections to it, because they didn't want to negotiate at the time. It was Ariel Sharon was the prime minister. He wasn't engaged in negotiations particularly. At the time, it was very interesting. We were pressing Arafat in 2002 to devolve power from his office of the presidency into a newly created position of prime minister. And it was we, the United States, who insisted on the establishment of a prime minister position in the Palestinian government. It didn't exist. And I remember hearing this when I was on Tel Aviv and thinking, who would ever think to go to Arafat and say, gee, give up some of your power to somebody else? Well, he did it nominally, and he appointed Abu Mazen as his prime minister, and then he never gave him any power whatsoever. And we tried to work through Abu Mazen, who had no power, so went nowhere. Then he tried it through Abu Allah, Ahmed Karay, and that didn't work. And then he brought back Mahmoud Abbas again, and that didn't work. And then finally Arafat died, and Mahmoud Abbas became the president. The problem was that then in the U.S. demanded elections of 2006, Hamas won the elections in free and fair certified elections. They won the government with a plurality of the vote.
Now, this was Condoleezza Rice, correct?
This was Condoleezza Rice. Condoleezza Rice insisted...
What made her think... I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but what made her think... What evidence did she have that Fatah would win?
A lot of hope.
Listen, she was a Soviet specialist. She was never a Middle East hand, and she was out of her element in the Middle East.
Yeah, it was hope. It was this idea that the people we're talking to will win. They're our guys. In fact, interestingly, I came into my office one day, and there was a young man sitting there. Turned out he was a former, I guess then current Army captain on detail through any number of agencies. And he was there to brief me on the... I won't say covert, but the unpublicized United States government plan to make sure that Fatah won the elections. And we were sending money in, millions of dollars, in order to support Mahmoud Abbas and Fatah, and how we were going to sweep the elections. And it even came down to the point where we built them a Palestinian media and press center where we chose the color of the backdrop drapes, because that was where Mahmoud Abbas would stand when he declared victory in the elections. So we're doing all this. And he's telling me that we're going to do this and nobody's going to catch on to the fact that the United States is doing this. So he and I had a very frank discussion about how that was never going to be kept quiet. And, of course, it wasn't. But there was this idea that we were going to manipulate everything and be the campaign staff, the PR people, to get Mahmoud Abbas and Fatah to win the parliamentary elections. So, as you know well from Elizabeth Brumiller's book, Washington Post staffer, Condoleezza Rice was on her treadmill at dark 30 of 0600 hours on the morning after the election when the, I guess, CNN news report came across and said Hamas wins the elections with a plurality, not a majority, but a plurality, and caught her completely off guard. So they were just deluding themselves.
American intelligence, yeah, that we thought right. Fatah was going to win.
Norm, I want to ask you a question.
Hit the bit here,
so I want to ask Norm a question.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
When Ehud Barak and Arafat and Bill Clinton met at Camp David, and they came up with the Camp David Accord, which was to be the final settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. The U.S. was going for it. Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister at the time, thought he could sell it. Why did Arafat get cold feet at the last minute?
That was kind of my question of a few minutes ago.
Well, there's a lot of legend that has been built out of that, and a lot of it has been built on a desire to lay blame somewhere. And I have some knowledge myself from talking to people who were there. I was not there, so I speak from what I've gathered. And there was also a good deal of evidence in Aaron Miller's book about the peace process, because Aaron Miller was there. He was a staffer along with Dennis Ross on the peace process. And among other things, Aaron, who is now not in the administration, in part because of this book, points out that, in fact, nothing was even considered on the U.S. side until it was run past the Israelis for vetting, that sort of thing. So it wasn't run past the Palestinians. It was run past the Israelis. And then if the Israelis agreed, it could be passed to the Palestinians. But what really came out of that, as far as I know, is that the offer, this great offer of 93 or 95 or 97% of the West Bank and everything else, never actually existed. And I came upon this because at the time, I was looking at maps, and I was looking at the shaded areas and how this is all going to work. And I, without a computer, looking at it, you couldn't make the numbers of the percentages and the contiguity of the Palestinian enclaves mesh with the rhetoric that was being given out about what a great deal it was for the Palestinians. So when I finally got back to Tel Aviv in 2002, on the way out, I stopped into a particular office in the State Department, because I don't want to burn any bridges here, and asked a very key person who had been involved in all those things. And basically the answer that person gave me was, it didn't really exist. The numbers didn't match the rhetoric. The reality on the ground didn't match the rhetoric. But when it fell apart and Barak got cold feet and Arafat rejected it because he understood what it meant, it had to be blamed on somebody. And it wasn't going to be blamed on the Israelis, so it was blamed on Arafat, who's very easy to blame. Remember, he was vastly corrupt. He was vastly power-hungry. All the horrible things you ever heard about him are true. You know, he was a real tyrant in a way, although not as bloodthirsty as historical tyrants. But he, it was very easy to blame him. I would say the agreement never existed as publicized.
Now there, your whole hour and a half was worth it.
Well, that's a pretty strong statement. I've often wondered why Arafat took that stance. I thought this was the opening he was waiting for, that he had been negotiating for, and that this was going to give him what he wanted.
So wait a minute. So, but you just heard this man say the Israelis manipulated the situation to turn Arafat into a goat.
I wouldn't say it was manipulated. It's that, you know, are the Israelis going to say, well, we actually didn't offer them as good a program as we said? Or is Bill Clinton going to say, gee, well, we really weren't offering that good a deal?
Clinton blames Arafat.
But it's sort of, you know, lies, damned lies and statistics. I suppose if you calculate the terms a certain way, then, well, 97% of the West Bank, except that the 3% is 1,000 lines and cross-sections that divide up the West Bank and over which a Palestinian can't cross. See what I mean?
Still boxed in.
Yeah, they're still boxed in. They still have trade control. They still have foreign defense control. They still have Israeli security forces running around in the dead of night. There's a whole bunch of issues. And I'm not trying to be specific, but the answer was the deal wasn't the wonderful utopian deal that everybody made it out to be afterward.
And Bill Clinton needed somebody to blame, not himself.
Hmm. Yeah. And I'm not even sure. I'm not even sure it's characterized that way, but how do you describe it when things fail? You know, everybody's standing before the cameras, and Arafat did, in fact, reject it. Do you then stand there and say, well, I can understand why he rejected my proposal because it wasn't as good a proposal as I made it out to be? Well, of course you don't. The proposal wasn't that great. Now you look at it, a decade later, maybe they should have taken it.
Okay, guys, you heard it from the men who were there on the ground when all this was happening. So if you've ever wondered why that deal fell through and whether Arafat was the fool that everybody made him out to be, or whether the American media presented the facts incorrectly, and there really wasn't an offer that was going to help the Palestinians. I'm going to play a little music here because I want you guys to be thinking about some of this stuff. And when I go to a bar and I talk to people or whatever, they always say to me, you know, I'd like to ask those guys why they don't try this or why they don't try that. And so I don't see my phone line lighting up. So if anybody's out there that has some brilliant idea or wants to run it by two men who know more about it than anybody I know, pick up the damn phone and call us, 593-0013. And now we're going to listen to some more music from the Middle East. Back in the studio, we have a caller who has a question she wants to present to our guest. So, caller, you don't have to identify yourself. Just go ahead with your question, and they'll both take a whack at it.
Well, thank you very much for being there. This is a fascinating show, and I'm learning a lot. And my question, I hope it's not a stupid question, but I have to ask it because I've read this, that there's a major focus on the Dome of the Rock, and I don't really know much about what that means, but could you explain and what you know about that?
Yes, we have somebody here who can explain it very well.
Thank
Walter,
you.
Walter, thank you for calling. Walter?
There are three of the holiest shrines in Islam. One of them is Mecca, the other is Medina, and the other is what the Arabs call Al-Quds, which is Jerusalem. And the Dome of the Rock is this beautiful gold dome, which I think is about 9th century. And it's built over the rock, which traditionally, and there's no historic proof of this, that Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his firstborn son, Isaac, on that rock. And of course, as you know, the biblical story, God interferes and says, no, you don't have to do it. Interestingly, from the Arab perspective, that particular rock, if you look at it, the guides will tell you, now you see that mark down there? That's the hoof print of Muhammad's horse when he flew around the heavens at night. So it has great symbolic significance, of course, to the Islamic world. Actually, it's the mosque about 75 or 100 yards away, which is even more sacred. But the Dome of the Rock is very important, again, because of the Abrahamic sacrifice there. And, of course, in Arabic, Abraham is Ibrahim. And that's very important to Arabs for that, and or Muslims. And also because of the fact that when Muhammad, the prophet, peace be upon his name, decided to fly around the heavens on his horse one night and was looking down on the earth, that particular rock, which now has the gold dome over it, is the point from whence the prophet launched out on this all-night flight through the heavens, which is kind of an interesting flight, but we're not going into that here.
Okay. I hope that answers your question, caller. We're running out of time, even though I've taken a second hour. I I told my guests, even before the show started, that I was going to try to ask them the million-dollar question, since I don't have access to Obama or any of the other world leaders, whether there's some kind of framework, some beginning point where we could set up a mechanism, whatever that might be, to begin to deal with all these issues of previous ownership and dealing with the religious aspects, et cetera, et cetera. So that's going to be my last question to both of you. I don't expect you to come up with some Solomon-like decision, because if it was so simple, somebody else would have come up with it. But to the extent that you can, is there anything that you see on the horizon, any methodology where we can get the parties to sit down and deal with this issue? Is it money? Is it land? Is it politics? Is it power? Is it all of these things? And is there any hope, guys? Is there any hope that somehow a resolution can be brought about?
Let me pick this up with a vignette. My short answer to the question is, if there's hope, I don't see it. I don't think the Israelis are willing to pay the price for peace. I'm not even sure the Palestinians are willing to pay the price that's necessary. And the fact that the wild card in the deck is the growing Iranian influence in the Levant. But the good news is I've been wrong. In 1986, I was in Estonia, Soviet Estonia, and this wonderful young woman came up to me. She was my translator, and she said, "Do you think I'll ever be able to travel and ever get out of the Soviet Union and see Europe?" And I said, "Of course not. It's never going to happen. Don't worry about it. The KGB, the military, the party, they're never going to fall apart, and nothing's ever going to allow you to get out of Estonia and see the world like other people do."
But indeed it happens.
Yeah, that's right, and that's the only hope there is. I'm wrong. Okay. If I'm wrong, then there's hope.
You want to be wrong.
Oh, sure.
Norman, I know it's a prickly question. It's probably even unfair, but I don't know who else I can ask, so you guys are going to have to deal with it. Any possibility... Any instrument, any methodology that could be used to bring this thing?
Well, if I didn't have hope, then I wouldn't be on this show and I wouldn't be speaking to audiences trying to advise them and get them to learn about the root causes of this conflict, why it's not just a conflict of a bunch of rabid Jews and rabid Arabs out there killing each other because they hate each other. There are fundamental issues here, fundamental issues that would resound with any American who's ever had his property taken, who has ever been jailed for voicing thoughts that were not in line with the current administration. It has happened many times over the course of our history. I strongly believe that the United States has to remain engaged, A, because it's a humanitarian issue and an issue of justice. And part of the problem I see comes from the fact, as many throughout the world know, but not much seen here in the United States, as far as I can tell, since World War II, the United States has, in every case of conflict, insisted through the United Nations and other fora on the absolute right of return and or compensation for refugees from armed conflict. And there are UN resolutions making the acquisition of land by territory by conflict inadmissible, that is, illegal under international law and other things. In only two cases in the world that I've been able to identify has the United States not insisted on the right of return and or compensation. One is in the case of the Sudeten Germans, which Czechoslovakia, then Czechoslovakia, refused to allow to return. These were ethnic Germans on which Hitler based the invasion of Czechoslovakia, saying that they were being persecuted by the Czechs. And at the end of World War II, the Czech authorities would not allow those Sudeten Germans to return to Czechoslovakia. The United States did not intercede then to demand their return. The only other case since then is that of Palestinian refugees. In every other case, in Burma, in East Timor, in any country you can name, the United States insists and presses and uses international sanctions to press for the right of return and or compensation for refugees. So the rest of the world looks at this and says, so let's see, why is it that the United States doesn't press for it in the case of Palestinians? Ah, it's because of, quote, the Jews, as they refer to them. And it, actually, that's the way Israelis refer to themselves, too, as the Jews. It's become kind of, it's, in the United States, it's seen as a pejorative term, a racist term to say the Jews. But the Jews are the Jewish people. So the United States needs to stay engaged because of that, because it's a human rights and humanitarian issue. It also needs to stay engaged because it has dire implications for our conduct overseas. You know, when I joined the Foreign Service, there was only one post in the world that we called unaccompanied. That is, where if you were a Foreign Service officer, you couldn't take your family, and that was Lebanon at the height of the Civil War. We now have about 15 unaccompanied posts, including Iraq and Afghanistan, where diplomats cannot take their post. We're growing enemies around the world, and I think that General Petraeus has seen this. Admiral Mullen has seen this, and they've commented on it publicly in testimony to the media. I think we're growing enemies in large part because we don't recognize or understand the complications involved in foreign policy in other cultures, why various peoples are engaging in civil war or rebellion or incitement in their own countries. And by not knowing that and not knowing the foundational issues, we intercede in a negative way. I think that's happening in several countries now. I don't want to get into specifics, but the preponderance of our engagements all over the world is growing.
Okay. I think we're going to have to wrap things up. You've done what I've asked you to do, and I appreciate it. I appreciate your even coming here. I did want to give my listeners, if possible, the opportunity to talk to you guys when the show is over, because sometimes people think about this stuff and say, damn it, why didn't I call and ask about that? Is there any way that our listeners can get in touch with either one of you fellas, either through a website or Facebook or some method of communication in case they want to get in touch with you later and ask you some? And this could be, you know, 6 months from now. Who knows what's going to be happening? Walter, do you have a Facebook? Or?
I'm retired, and like a good spy, I've gone gray, and, you know, I'll find you if you want to, but I'm not on Facebook or any of those sites. And
social connections?
No.
Okay. All right, so we're just going to have to read your columns.
They write you a letter. They can get them to write you a letter, and you can send it to me.
Okay, to hear that, Walter's made an offer. If you have anything you want him to ask about, send me a letter, and I'll be sure to send it on to him. And you're liable to wind up in the Christian Science Monitor down the road.
Well, that's the column I write. I mean, that's who I write for.
I know.
But I'm not staff, and they can fire me any minute, but they don't seem to want to.
No, I mean, I'm surprised you guys aren't being plucked to serve on some kind of a special commission to help these guys sort out all this stuff. Norman? Okay, I've got one for Norman. You guys got a pencil out there. You might want to write this down. This is a website, Norman?
That's an email address.
Email address, okay. Navigator at Olsen, that's spelled Olsen, no caps, no breaks, global, global.com. Navigator at Olsen, did I say that was Olsen, global.com. So if you want to get in touch with Norman, that's the way you can do it. Walter... Boy, I'm telling you, Walter's a tough guy. I can see why nobody ever walked on him. You remind me of an uncle of mine that didn't fool around.
And what happened to him?
He's still alive.
Well, there you go. I want to stay alive, too.
I hear you, my friend. All right, guys, we're going to wrap the show up today. I want to thank my sponsor, Sweets and Meats, 218 South Main Street, south end of town, opposite where the old MBNA building used to be. And I want to thank Kel Chapman, my producer, for coming up with some interesting music that I'm sure you guys are wondering, what kind of music is he playing today? But I want to thank these two gentlemen. I'm going to be playing this tape over and over and over again because they said so many things that I've just got to chew on. So you know where we are, folks. If you ever have any questions, you can always get in touch with them through me. And I got a lot of good guests coming up in the coming weeks. You'll be told about it. One of them is a UFO conference that's going on in Washington, D.C., where the guys who were at the secret bases when the UFOs apparently landed there, they're going to tell us some hair-raising stories about what they say the truth is. That's coming up. We've got one of the candidates for council here in Rockland who's going to come on the show and tell us why he could do a better job than the current crop can. And so we've got some real good stuff coming up, so stay with me. This is Terry Martin, your host of Talk Around Town. And my producer's trying to tell me something, and I'm not sure
next
what
he's...
Next week I'm going to have off. Whoa, going to be able to take my family on a short vacation. But from here on in, it's not going to be every other week. I'm going to have guests on every week for literally the next month. So stay with us, WRFR-FM in Rockland. 99.3 in Camden, and it's been wonderful sharing this day with you, and I want to especially thank my two guests. My God, my head's still spinning from both of you for some of the stuff you've laid on us, so I want to thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, that's it for this week. Thank you all.
Oh,